Welcome to the virtual John Jay Homestead and the last of our 2021 Zoom Talks. I'm Melissa Vale, trustee of the Friends and chair of the Scholars Committee. Thank you all for experimenting with us through this most unusual season and for taking time off from filling out your brackets tonight. First, some webinar logistics. You're all muted and video view is turned off. If you have technical problems, please use the chat function for messages to your host. After an introduction, Professor Wineapple will talk. She has asked us to round up some questions from our committee to use to structure our hour, and you've given us some great ones, but we welcome more. So please use the raise hand feature at the bottom of your screen. If you hit that, we'll announce and unmute you, and you'll get to ask your question yourself. Special thanks to our lectures committee for their indispensable support of these talks, and to our excellent public partner, the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, for everything. And as always, and most important, our members, who are our reason for being. If you're not yet a member, please look at the website and see all the things that our members make possible, from these and other public and education programs to site support to collections care and research. We couldn't do it without our members, and we have no capacity limit on the number of members that we allow. Upcoming events, May 1st, we'll be here before we know it, and we'll bring the opening day of our farm market. June 5th, we'll bring our On the Farm dinner celebrating the outside offerings of this beautiful site. And of course, our trails and gardens are always open dawn to dusk. Please visit. Now we get to turn to the subject of the evening, and here's an advantage to Zoom, our ability to conduct a short survey. I'm going to ask you a question, which will help Professor Wineapple to get to know us a little bit and might inform our discussion. There's no right answer here, and if you find you've changed your mind by the end of the talk, that is a good thing. Here's the question. When do you think you'll see an impeachment of a president or vice president resulting in conviction and removal from office? By the end of 4 years from now? By the end of 12 years from now? More than 12 years from now, or never? Please vote. We're also asking you how many times you visited the homestead, and I think we also ask you if you're members. So we use that to help us know what our audience is like, especially in this unusual year. Now, those of you who've come to our talks before know that we always look for a Jay connection to the topic of the evening, and here goes. One of the unusual features of this founding family is the fact that it was intact over multiple generations and populated by people who continued to be leaders in the issues of their day. John Jay was followed by his son William, an abolitionist leader, then by John Jay II, minister to Austria-Hungary, also active in the defense of people of color at risk of kidnapping during the fugitive slave law period. Then, if we were in our handsome ballroom at the homestead, you could see the portrait of John Jay's great-grandson, Colonel William Jay, by John Singer Sargent. And outside under the rose arbor, you could see a stone engraved to Old Fred, horse that carried Colonel Jay through several major battles of the Civil War, including Bull Run, Chancellorsville, Mine Run, Gettysburg, and Appomattox. It was said that Colonel Jay was protected from the fiercest fighting by the influence of his father. And when he had earlier been posted at Fort Monroe, he found it boring and asked for his, quote, horse, his servant, his cigar collection, bottles of wine, and articles of clothing that would better fit the environment of Fort Monroe, close quote. Nonetheless, it was a standard tactic to try to shoot the horses of officers out from under them. And so under any circumstances, it is significant that Old Fred and Colonel Jay both survived those terrible battles. And back to the topic of the evening, it was Andrew Johnson, as president, who promoted him to the rank of lieutenant colonel in 1865. Please note that's after Appomattox, although he was called Colonel Jay for the rest of his life. General Meade approved his resignation later in 1865, commending his gallantry and zeal and the intelligence he has ever displayed since being under my command. Now our speaker. Brenda Wineapple is an award-winning essayist, academic, and critic known for being equally at home in cultural and political history. Currently teaching at Columbia and the New School, she's author also of biographies of Nathaniel Hawthorne, Janet Flanner, Gertrude and Leo Stein, and was previously the director and writer-in-residence of the Leon Levy Center for Biography at the Graduate School, CUNY. The Impeachers was published 6 years ago and has been called absorbing, important, superbly lyrical, and vivid and sweeping, and was named one of the New York Times best books of the year. Welcome, Brenda Wineapple.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Melissa. It's such a pleasure to be with you and all of you this evening. I'm sorry I can't be with you in your beautiful, at your beautiful homestead, but none of us are there tonight. So we just make do with this very, very unusual year. And we can all hope that it will be ended soon. But I'm very delighted with all the hard work that Melissa did and all the people behind the scenes in making sure that I'm here tonight with you to talk about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, what happened, how it happened, and maybe from your questions, I think we want lessons to learn from it. I'm not sure about that necessarily, but we'll see. We'll see what you have to say. I would say one slight correction. That my book did not come out 6 years ago. It came out only in the spring of 2019. So it was actually just, it's perfectly okay, but it's interesting because 6 years ago was a very different time. And when my book came out, it was very close to the very first impeachment of Donald J. Trump. Although, of course, when I chose to write the book and when I did the research, there was no Trump, no Donald Trump on the horizon. And in fact, I actually began the book about 6 or 7 years before. I began the book when we were deep into the Obama presidency. It was about 2013, 14, I had just published a book called Ecstatic Nation. And so when I was starting, impeachment was on absolutely no one's mind at all. Very few books had been written about it. People really didn't understand it. People, in fact, weren't interested in it. And that is exactly one of the reasons that I found it interesting. It seemed to me to be a major event in American history that had gone almost untouched, which is rather unusual. And so one of the first questions that I asked, because I always begin my books with a question that I wanted to answer, was not just what happened, but why was such an important historical event seemingly ignored. And if I mentioned impeachment, the impeachment of Johnson to people, that the only response that I got was some reference to JFK's 1956 Pulitzer Prize winning Profiles in Courage that a lot of people either still remembered or more to the point that they had heard of often. It's a phrase that comes up quite a bit. And if they remembered anything about that book besides the title or the fact that maybe Kennedy didn't write it, was the fact that one of the chapters was on a man named Edmund Ross. He was the junior senator from Kansas, and he was the person who cast the deciding vote to acquit Andrew Johnson. And it's important because Andrew Johnson was acquitted only by one vote, only one vote. And so Kennedy hailed Ross as a profile in courage because Ross presumably stood up against his own party, which were at the time were the Republicans, not the same as the Republicans today, but they were the Republicans. And what Kennedy or Sorensen or whoever wrote the book did was that they soft-pedaled the notion that Ross was probably bribed. And if he wasn't exactly bribed, he knew very well that he'd be repaid when he asked Johnson after the vote for favors, perks, what we today call quid pro quo. The book also said, Kennedy also said, that fanatics had victimized poor Andrew Johnson. And really, in a sense, what Kennedy is drawing on, or whoever wrote the book, was drawing on the myth of the lost cause. And one of the great, I think, examples of that lost cause, some of you, if not all of you, are familiar with D.W. Griffith's Birth of the Nation, where the characters in my book, The Impeachers, for example, are depicted as fiends diabolically bent on destroying and humiliating the white South. And so as for impeachment itself, the point of view that Kennedy was giving us and that was still extant and still perhaps is to a certain extent, I certainly hope not. And he said, and I'm quoting from his book now, that the actual cause for which the president, Johnson, was impeached and tried was not fundamental to the nation. And I think that's important, and it's important to remember, and I'll come back to that. But for me, having just finished a book that was really about the before, during, and after the Civil War, even though I didn't know the J connection to the war, I apologize. But that impeachment, actually, Johnson's impeachment, took place just 3 short years after the first ever presidential first ever presidential assassination. And that, of course, took place after a brutal, galling, terrible civil war. So to me, that was amazing. It was amazing that this event occurred really on the heels of the Civil War and on the heels of the death of Abraham Lincoln. And because of that timing, it became clear that really what we as a nation were facing and that Johnson as president was facing, which is the direction the entire country would take after the war. In other words, under what terms, for example, would the 11 seceded states of the so-called former Confederacy be allowed to re-enter the Union? Should they just be invited back as if they hadn't waged war against the Union and welcomed back into the House and the Senate, as if they'd never left? That was a real question. And Congress, as you probably know, gets to decide the qualifications of its own members. But Johnson, who took over the presidency in April of 1865, when Congress was recessed, didn't call a special session of Congress to deal with these issues. What he did was, by executive action, things we're familiar with today, he single-handedly reestablished the Southern state governments, and argued that since the Constitution forbids secession, the Union had never been dissolved. It's like saying murder is against the law. The law forbids murder. So the fact that X killed Y couldn't have happened. But as a consequence to Johnson's way of thinking, the Southern states should be welcomed back, resume their place in the federal government, their former rights and privileges restored. As soon as they could be deemed loyal, they just had to renounce secession, accept the 13th Amendment, slavery's abolition, and swear allegiance to the government. And they would get back all of their legal and property rights, except, of course, their ownership of other people. And that brings us to the essential question. What about the 4 million formerly enslaved men and women who had recently been freed but had been deprived of everything during their lives, even the ability to read and write? What about them? What about their civil rights? Shouldn't they be allowed to control their education, employment, representation, even in government? Black leaders, white representatives asked, weren't they citizens? Johnson had an answer, very specific answer. His answer was this. He said, this is a country for white men, and by God, as long as I'm president, it shall be a government for and by white men. So you might say, who was this Andrew Johnson? How did he ever get on the ticket in 1864 on Lincoln's ticket? Well, he was a self-made man like Lincoln in some ways, born in a log cabin. And in 1860, he was a hero to the North because he was the only Southern senator who stood up and spoke out against secession and for the preservation of the Union after Lincoln's election, because he thought slavery was better protected within the Union. But, and for his pains in Tennessee, he represented Tennessee, he was burnt in effigy from one end of the state for another, but he was considered a hero. And even Lincoln was very aware of Johnson's popularity in the North. Lincoln didn't know what we know, which is that he was going to win the election, for one thing. He was very worried about that. And also, he didn't know he was going to be assassinated. So he did what all politicians seem to do. He wanted to balance the ticket so he could win. So to balance the ticket, what's better than choosing somebody from the opposition party? Johnson was a Democrat, Lincoln was a Republican, and choosing somebody from the South to keep the border states happy. And Johnson himself had said treason is a crime, secession therefore is a crime. So it seemed fine. Of course, then we know what happens. Lincoln was assassinated. And as I said, right afterwards, Johnson did not call a special session of Congress, but he started pardoning former Confederates, high-ranking ones, right and left. He had a hands-off policy of the South, which allowed states' rights, called home rule, to be the order of the day. And so what happened is in the South, one legislature after another started passing what were called black codes, which were designed to prevent the freedmen and women from owning property, traveling freely, making contracts, and enjoying any form of civil rights or due process. And in those legislatures, they elected in the South so many former Confederates to high office that, for example, the Louisiana state legislature was called the rebel legislature. And the police in Louisiana, particularly in New Orleans, were organized as a state militia, because most of the police in that particular force had been former Confederates. They made up two-thirds of the force. And for another example, in New Orleans, and this was happening all over the South, a convention was held to discuss black voting rights, and within hours, over 100 black men and women were executed point blank while they kneeled and prayed for their lives, and then their corpses were kicked and stabbed. General Phil Sheridan, who was there, he wasn't there, and he came back to New Orleans at the time. He said, this is nothing short of a massacre. And he was not exactly what we would call radical today. Meantime, Johnson, back in the White House, is vetoing legislation such as the Civil Rights Bill. The Civil Rights Bill conferred equal protection under the law for all citizens. That's all. It's not very radical. Congress passed the 14th Amendment as a result. But I should say Congress overrode the veto because they had the power to do that. And they were consistently overriding Johnson's veto. But they saw what was up. And so they passed the 14th Amendment to actually enshrine in the Constitution civil rights. right after Congress passed that in the summer of 1866, Johnson rallied, he went around the country to rally support against the ratification of the 14th Amendment. During the trip, he went on a real tear. People thought he was drunk because they couldn't believe the way he behaved. And he was yelling that the congressmen in Washington who opposed him should be hanged. Lock them up. He didn't even say lock them up. He said they should be hanged. Ulysses S. Grant, the next president, as you know, and the war hero, who was forced to travel with Johnson, was so mortified, he got drunk and had to be locked into a baggage car so that he wouldn't humiliate himself further. He was horrified at Johnson's behavior. But make no mistake, even with that, the decision and then the vote for impeachment of this man hadn't come easily or quickly. The issue, a couple of times, certain people in the Republican caucus, progressives, radicals, whatever you want to call them, tried to vote for Johnson's impeachment based on his behavior, and it just didn't go anywhere, all right? Because, after all, as I said, a war had just been fought, and no one knew what impeachment of the president of the United States would mean, or even what grounds were necessary. We all know bribery and treason. Okay, that seems clear, but you can be impeached for high crimes if you're a president and misdemeanors. What are high crimes and misdemeanors? That's complicated and unclear. Alexander Hamilton had said that a high crime is an abuse of executive authority proceeding from an abuse or violation of public trust. So impeachment then to him is an inquest into the conduct of public men, but that raises a question. It's a very simple question, and we've been dealing with it in one way or another, which is to say, should an impeachment proceed because of an actual violation of law, right? You break a law, you're impeached, or can you be impeached for what Hamilton was calling a violation of public trust? In other words, if I put it another way, I can say, does the president have to commit illegal acts and hence demonstrably impeachable ones? And even that's a problem, because if you steal a chicken, can you be impeached for that? Is that important enough? Or for getting illegal, does impeachment require not a criminal offense, a breaking of the law, but an abuse of power, a subversion of Congress, say, and a failure to execute the laws of the people, which isn't exactly a violation of the law. So that is to say, shouldn't someone in power be held accountable for their actions? Should deplorable, bigoted, reckless acts be considered impeachable? These are hard questions. They were hard then, they're hard today. So to avoid that, Congress was seeking other means to thwart Andrew Johnson and his violent race-baiting and avowedly supremacist policies with legislation that overall had been moderate. And as I mentioned, civil rights legislation did not confer political rights, and neither did the 14th Amendment. But Congress had to do something else, because Johnson needed to be reined in terms of he was giving away, many people thought, everything for which the Civil War had been fought. And so to consolidate the achievement of the war, what Congress did was confer voting rights on Southern Black men, which Johnson, of course, said would weaken and degrade and destroy the government. It also mandated, Congress mandated, that the armed forces, the army, to keep the peace in the South, because as I suggested, New Orleans wasn't an outlier. There was terrible violence going on in the South against Black people and against, of course, white Republicans as well. In order to keep the peace, especially at the polls, the army was supposed to prevent violence and to do this to protect the army, which was protecting Black people in the South. Right? Congress also passed a constitutionally dubious law called the Tenure of Office Act. And what they were trying to do is protect the Secretary of War, a man named Edwin Stanton, because the Secretary of War protected the army and the army protected Black people. And what the Tenure of Office Act said, because Johnson hated Stanton, who'd become more and more radical and against Johnson. Johnson had a great ability to unite disparate parts of, say, the Republicans against him. He brought people together, in fact, because he himself was so awful, people forgot their differences in uniting against him. So Congress passed this Tenure of Office Act to protect Stanton. And what the act said is that if, for example, the Senate confirms someone, then that officer cannot be fired without the Senate's approval. So if you're confirmed by the Senate, you can't be fired unless the Senate approves that firing. What does Johnson do? He immediately violates the Tenure of Office Act and wants to get rid of Stanton, right? He got rid of him. He fired him. Congress wasn't in session. When Congress came back, Stanton wouldn't leave because he knew he had Congress behind him. When Congress came back, they backed Stanton. And then what happened? Stanton locked himself in his office, refused to give up the key, can't make this stuff up. But the fact of the matter was that Johnson had openly and eagerly defied Congress. He insulted it, he broke the law. And that was the legal pretext that many in the House of Representatives had been waiting for. They felt that they no longer had a choice. They no longer could pass legislation to rein this person in. They had to vote, and they voted overwhelmingly, 126-47, to undertake the extraordinary step, first ever impeachment of an American president. Johnson was subsequently tried in the Senate. And it's a very interesting phenomenon, just as an aside. This was 1868 by this time, an election year. Johnson was tried in the Senate. And as I said, he was acquitted by just one vote. That was the vote, as we said, or I said earlier, of the profiled and courage. I said once when I was asked, do I think Edmund Ross is a profile in courage? And I said, no, I think he's a profile in cowardice, actually. The guy was not a hero. And moreover, and I think this is so important, the impeachment of Andrew Johnson was not, as Kennedy wrote, a mistaken incident in American history. It was not organized by a group of fanatics because Andrew Johnson was not impeached for violating the Tenure of Office alone, Tenure of Office Act alone. That was only the efficient cause. Behind it was the recognition, even by those who'd been reluctant impeachers, and there were many, that impeachment was absolutely central to the nation, to its welfare, and to its future, because that future had been envisioned for a long time, for before the war, had been a future envisioned by those who understood and believed that the time had come and was long overdue to create a free and fair country. This is one of the last great battles with slavery. Charles Sumner, the senator, some of you may know who he is, from Massachusetts, longtime abolitionist who was beaten in 1857 within an inch of his life for having insulted one of the slavery senators. He said, he stood up and he said, this, the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, is one of the last great battles with slavery. That's what impeachment was to him. And that is to say that fairness and equality and a redefinition of the country were to very many the reason that the war had been fought in the first place. The impeachment of the president will be a hopeful indication of the triumph of our right to vote, Frederick Douglass said. It will mean, he continued, that the South shall no longer be governed by the Ku Klux Klan, but by fair and impartial law. Because the way Johnson had allowed the South to reorganize itself gave rise, as you see, unfortunately, in Birth of a Nation, gave rise to the Ku Klux Klan. And that was one of the issues, believe it or not, that actually came up during the impeachment trial. Frederick Douglass was half right, I think. The impeachment process was a hopeful indication of the right of Black men to vote. As an aside, I'll say, Black women were not the issue, and women of any color, of all colors, were not the issue. Forget women. Women are not even on the docket. In fact, as another aside, as I mentioned, it was 1868. It was an election year, which figured into some people's concern about the impeachment, because if Johnson had been impeached, since he had been Lincoln's vice president, there was no vice president. So at the time in 1868, what that meant was that the president would be the head, the president pro tempore of the Senate. It was a man named Benjamin Wade. Benjamin Wade was considered a progressive and in fact made people very nervous in the Republican Party because they wanted to make sure Grant got elected and Grant was more moderate. And one of the things that everyone worried about is that if we impeach, if we vote to impeach Andrew Johnson and Ben Wade gets into the White House, he's probably going to put Susan B. Anthony in the cabinet, and we can't have that. So, you know, better to keep Andrew Johnson than to have a woman in the cabinet. But that's just as an aside. I want to go back to what the meaning of impeachment was for the people on the ground at the time, because I think that's what's so important. And as I mentioned to you, Frederick Douglass thought that it was a hopeful indication of the triumph of the right to vote, and in some sense would really spell not just the end of slavery, because slavery was over, but the end of the pernicious effects of slavery, because that's what was at stake. So really, in that particular sense, the impeachment was an indication, a hopeful indication, of the way America was changing and could change. And it was very possible that it could change in that way. So to conclude, or to begin to conclude, go back to where I started, which is why we didn't know about this, why I didn't know about this. I'm a fairly literate person. I know a fair amount about American history and culture, but I didn't know very much about this. And I wondered why that was the case, why it was that this seemed to many, even in 2018-19, I remember reading a front page piece in the New York Times where the impeachment of Johnson was called for preposterous reasons. And I thought, no, that's not it at all. But I did come to firmly believe, and I do firmly believe, that the reason we didn't know, I didn't know, I'm assuming you didn't, I could be wrong, about the impeachment and trial of Andrew Johnson was because we really didn't know what it was about, and we didn't want to know what it was about. People at the time knew what it was about. It was about race. It was about the racial structure of the country. And the impeachment in that particular sense represented yet another attempt to preserve the Union and free the slaves, which to those who wanted Johnson impeached were the same thing. To preserve the union meant creating a more perfect one, liberated at last from, as I said, the noxious and lingering effects of an appalling institution that treated human beings as property. And so, the actual cause for which the president, Johnson, was impeached and tried was not fundamental to the nation. That's what Kennedy said. No, it was quite fundamental to the nation, and it was fundamental to the Declaration. But of course, and I think this is important too, impeachment implied a failure, and not the failure of the impeachment to get rid of Andrew Johnson, but it implies a failure. Presidential impeachment implies a failure at the very top. But it also, because the president had failed in many ways. But as I'm suggesting, even with that, impeachment can imply the glimmer of a better time coming, a better government, a fairer one, a more just one. And it implied, and still does, it seems to me, and certainly in 1868, that the American president was not a king. One of the impeachers, Thaddeus Stevens from Pennsylvania, said that the president, American president, is not a king, that all actions have consequences, and that the national government, an experiment that was actually conceived in hope with its checks and balances, could courageously maintain itself without waging a war, even after one. And that the national government might actually, and soon, the impeachers felt, free itself from all vestiges of human oppression. And so it was, and is, fundamental to the nation, which, as I suggest, is ironically why we learned so little about it. But that impeachment and that reason seem very good to me. Thank you for your attention. I know I touched on some of your questions, but not all of them. And I've been happy to address whatever I can, however I can. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And Emily, why don't we start with our survey and see what our audience members thought about the question of whether this first failure to convict killed the power of impeachment to rein in an out of control president and turned impeachment into something that looks a lot closer to censure. Emily, do we have some great results here somewhere?
We do have some great results.
Okay.
82% say they do not expect to see an impeachment that results in a conviction in their lifetimes.
Yep. Ever. With okay.
18% saying 12 years, and only 2% thinking we might see Biden impeached.
Well, the question is whether we're getting ourselves into a pattern of revenge impeachments, and it seems that most of our audience thinks no, and that's a good result. Quickly down to the other ones, I see that a whole lot of people come regularly to the homestead, and that's wonderful, and I see that we're about half and half members and non-members, which means we have a lot of hunting ground. Or I never know what the right answer is to that question. So that's great. So that's what you mean by that the impeachment of Andrew Johnson had not succeeded, but had worked. That's such a great formulation. Just talk, I know you've addressed it, but just talk a little bit more about that.
Well, it had not succeeded because Andrew Johnson was allowed to stay in office for the rest of his term until the following March when Ulysses S. Grant took over. But two things that had happened. One, it worked because it did curtail any power that he might have had. And I should mention that in 1868, during the Democratic National Convention, he thought that that he was going to get the nomination from his former party, the Democrats. And they made some kind of statement about thanking him for his service, but there was no way they were going to touch him. He was completely toxic. So he was not going to be renominated, or he's not going to be nominated. And he was called the accidental president. I mean, he had a bullet put him in that office. He had never been elected. It was Lincoln's death that put him there. So that was one way it worked, certainly. But in a more profound way for us, and as I just said, impeachment took place basically right after the Civil War. And it suggested really that the country could maintain itself, even go through something as upsetting and confusing as impeachment, it could maintain itself without waging war, even right after a war. And so I think that that suggested that the basic underlying structure of the country was sound, and that there were people who really took the future of the country seriously and were trying to work within its parameters to make it a better place for everyone. So I think it worked in those two ways. Clipped Johnson's wings and maintained the structure of the government.
Wonderful. We have one question that came from a committee member before this evening, and then we'll get to the ones that are coming in at the bottom of the screen. This is from John Stockbridge. Had President Johnson not been from Tennessee, and had his Reconstruction plan not been more tolerant than that pushed by the ruling Republicans, would he still have been impeached for defying the Tenure of Office Act? And I know historians hate counterfactuals, but too bad.
No. I mean, that's a very good question, because really, and perhaps you're not expecting this answer, but there would have been, had those issues been the case, had he been more tolerant, then, and all this, and the other thing, I forget exactly how you phrased it, but had he been a different kind of person, had he worked with people who had been willing to work with him, there would have been no Tenure of Office Act. Easy.
So it was personality driven as well as
It was not personality driven. No. Absolutely okay. Not. No. I would never say that. It was his policies. I mean, his policies were egregious. They were unjust. They basically wanted to restore the country to what it was before the Civil War, just without slavery, but to invent and help the South invent ways to keep the formerly enslaved in all but other words. Absolutely. Had nothing to do with his personality. His personality wasn't helpful, but even Lincoln knew that the guy wasn't exactly, I don't know, warm and fuzzy and cordial and elegant. I mean, but he didn't care.
Are there any people, I had no idea that he had a second act and that he actually returned to the Senate. Are there any people who still hold him out as a man of principle, or is he completely a disgraced person?
Well, I can never say there's no one. There's probably somebody. I may get an email tonight saying, how dare you? You know, but by and large, no one. I mean, by and large, he is considered one of the worst presidents of the country, and there's a lot of competition for that. So, but excuse me, in terms of his second act, he did run for Congress representative twice, and he wasn't elected. But what happened was, in those days, the legislatures picked senators, and the Tennessee legislature sent Johnson in 1875 back to Congress. And you know, one of the first things he did was stand up and rant against Ulysses S. Grant, as predicted. He didn't last long because when Congress went out of, was out of session, he passed away. He'd been ill before, but no, he's a bad penny, and a bad penny comes back.
Okay. Here is a question from Mark Dillon. Chief Judge William Rehnquist wrote a book in 1992 called Grand Inquests, which you must know every word of, comparing and contrasting the Samuel Chase and Andrew Johnson impeachments. One of Rehnquist's conclusions was that the Johnson acquittal had the effect of deterring the impeachments of presidents for political reasons for over 100 years. But after that century, there was the threat of a Nixon impeachment and the actual impeachments of Presidents Clinton and Trump twice. In your view, has the impact of the Johnson acquittal been forgotten to the point where we've already gone down an increasingly slippery slope where impeachments are undertaken for conduct that does not rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, but motivated by partisanship having nothing to do with the actual constitutional standard?
It's a mouthful, and to do justice to the question, I would say that until sometime in the 20th century, beyond Kennedy, because this was Kennedy's point of view, which was that Johnson was impeached for quote unquote political reasons only, because the fanatic Republicans wanted to stay in power. Now, of course, he's going to like to say that because he's a Democrat and he'll soon be running for Congress, for president. So he himself is political. I would say in relation to that, that of course the Republicans who impeached Andrew Johnson were acting politically because they wanted to ensure civil rights for all people, pass the 14th Amendment and get it ratified. Everything that goes on in Washington is political. That doesn't mean it's necessarily horrific, opportunistic, disgusting, any of those things. That party wanted to stay in power in the same way that Abraham Lincoln, also a political creature, wanted to stay in power. So the premise that now it's just for political reasons, I think is complicated in the sense that we have to define what we mean by political in that sense. Johnson was definitely impeached for political reasons, but as I'm suggesting, those were the reasons for the war being fought, for the slaves being freed. The second part of the question, I'm just sort of separating out because it's an interesting question. The second part of the question, do I think that in recent past, say, impeachment will be used as a weapon? No, I think Nixon was threatened with the idea of impeachment. It never happened. I don't know what would have happened, but he resigned. So we have to take, in a sense, that off the table. Clinton was impeached for actions that I personally think were an abuse of power in one sense, but they didn't affect the office of the presidency. In terms of, you know, and when you think about it, there has been four impeachment. Well, is that right? One, two, three, four impeachments in the United States history. And two of them happened within a year and a half. So I think that has a lot to do with the person being impeached rather than political machinations. So, and I hope I did the question justice.
It's a big question. From Jack Billig here, did those who supported Johnson, that is those who did not vote to convict on the impeachment charges, represent mostly the Democrats, or were they a cross-section from both parties of those who oppose Reconstruction? And also, what happened to Stanton in his showdown?
Oh, what happened to Stanton? That's the easy thing. Stanton was fine. He stayed in his position. He said that after the impeachment trial, whatever happened, whether Johnson was convicted or not, that he was resigning. He was exhausted. I mean, he really, with Lincoln, had prosecuted the war. And then he wasn't well. He spent all his energy really on that war. And he was very sick and always wanted to be on the Supreme Court. And Grant nominated him, and Stanton died before he really could take the bench. So that's what happened to Stanton in that particular sense. I'm sorry, I don't remember the first part of the question. It was good though.
The first part of the question was, who were the ones who supported Johnson?
Yes.
Were they Democrats or were they a cross section?
No, they were called seven recusant Republicans, including Ross, who was the deciding vote. They were not opposed, they were in many cases progressive. They just weren't completely convinced by the impeachment managers. I went very carefully through the trial and dramatized it in the book. And the trial was very exciting. And on both sides, you have people making, I thought, brilliant arguments, constitutional and otherwise. So that with the exception of Ross, who's the real problem, as I suggested, the others, and there were a couple of others who were probably bribed, but a few of them really felt that either the tenure of office violation didn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense, or they voted, there were 11 articles and they wanted to vote for some and not others, but it was not that they stood in the way of the Reconstruction that we came to know under Grant, because they had been, two of them especially, had been authors of the civil rights legislation. So it gets very complicated. So it wasn't just the Democrats who saved Johnson.
So you're talking about Reconstruction under Grant. Is supposing there had been one more vote in the Senate and Johnson had been impeached, would Reconstruction have happened differently or sooner than it proceeded under Grant?
No, it would have happened in fairer and better ways much more quickly. Certainly, you would get more representation. You get more education to formerly enslaved, you'd get more money going into the South to help rebuild it. You would get more representatives in Congress more quickly, and you would get Susan B. Anthony in the cabinet. So
that's a great picture. You mentioned, here's from Michael Clark, you mentioned that this is not the same Republican Party. How did the party evolve?
That's a great question. The party, as I said, one of Johnson's talents was the ability to bring the Republican Party together. And the Republican Party was divided in three ways. It was the progressives, what we call progressives today. They were called radicals. They were the moderates. And it was a couple of the moderates, by the way, that voted to acquit, just a couple of them, the ones that weren't bribed. And there were conservatives, and Johnson united them. But after Johnson, especially under Grant, a group, they had been formerly, I think, moderates and conservatives, broke away, and they formed what was called the Liberal Republican Party. And they had a very different monetary policy. So you have to remember, the Republican Party started is an anti-slavery party. And as an anti-slavery party, not wanting the extension of slavery into the territories, it brought together disparate groups who had different ideas about finances and monetary policy and trade and tariffs. And so after the war and after Johnson, what you have is these different parts of the party begin to split asunder, so that the so-called liberal Republicans, they are the nucleus of today's Republican Party, because they did believe in free trade and they had a monetary policy that was very different from the radical or progressive Republicans. And then because the Grant administration itself was under such pressure, being accused all the time of corruption, everybody seemed to be corrupt, that gave the liberal Republicans more impetus. So they became the Republican Party. They grew into the Republican Party that we know today.
And you also have to talk about Johnson, President Johnson, and the Southern strategy, don't you?
You mean Lyndon Johnson?
Yeah.
That's much later, though. Yeah. That's a whole other thing. I mean, I only went up to, you know, the 1770s, 1780s in my my answer, because Republicans become very, I mean, when you have Teddy Roosevelt, Republican Party is very progressive because he has, you know, trust busting, so forth and so on. So it's but the Southern the Southern Democrats were the party really of Andrew Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was Johnson's view on secession completely an outlier? Was there a body of people who held the same view about the impossibility of secession?
There were people who held that view, but they weren't in power. The people in power, both in the states, in the governing bodies in the states, and also certainly in Congress, certainly in the Senate, he was definitely an outlier, And he was considered a traitor by people like Jefferson Davis, who's also a Southern senator, and probably some of the Copperheads, which were the Northern Democrats as well. But of course, in the South itself, there were, I'm sure, quite a number who weren't very happy about secession, but as I said, they did not have that kind of power as the, what they were called as the fire eaters who pushed for secession.
Mm-hmm. Here's from Ron Goldbrenner. Isn't it true that slavery bred the myth, the big lie of white supremacy and black inferiority, and Reconstruction was only a minimalist effort to overturn that big lie, and it failed?
Well, yes, up to a point, but Reconstruction failed. I wouldn't say that it failed at the time. I think that those people, even the reluctant impeachers, even the ones a couple of them who voted to acquit Johnson, they wanted it to succeed, which is why they made sure that there were voting rights. That's why they not only passed the 13th and the 14th Amendment, but the 15th Amendment after Johnson, so that in that sense, it was enormously successful, because suddenly in the 1870s and 80s, you have black men in Congress representing the South. I think what happens then, there's a push against that, the whole lost cause, the institution by the 1890s of Jim Crow. You have Plessy versus Ferguson, where you have, you start talking about so-called separate but equal. And I think that's what really both buried what was important about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson and also perpetuated this so-called big lie.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm afraid we're running out of time. And so we're going to thank everyone for hanging in there with us tonight and in this season, and look forward to the spring. And thank you, Brenda Wineapple, for your generosity with us tonight and for your wonderful and important book. It must have been an exciting moment when you realized you had a tiger by the tail on this topic. If I was wrong about when it was published, but if you started it 6 years ago, that was very prescient. And we're grateful to you for having seen the future in that way.
I wish I could have changed it.
Yeah, well, there we go. It's successful. What is it? It's effective, but not successful. It didn't succeed, but it worked.
Right.
Let's hope that these ones have worked too.
Yes. Thank you so much, Melissa and everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Please visit us, and we'll see you next season. Let's hope in person. Thank you.
Thank you.